So I'd now like to introduce Richard Cork, who, as you all know, is an award-winning critic, historian, broadcaster and curator of major exhibitions. His many books include A Groundbreaking Study of Vorticism, The History of Art Beyond the Gallery, and the groundbreaking exhibition A Bitter Truth, Avant-Garde and the Great War in 1994, a winner of the Art Fund Award in 1995. Most recently, hit the catalogue of his exhibition Wild Thing, Epstein, Godia, Bresca and Gill has become a standard text on those sculptors. And his new book is The Healing Presence of Art, A Major History of Western Art in Hospitals. Today he's going to talk to us about The Dance of Death, Young British Artists in the First World War. Richard, thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you show me how to...
I'm just wondering... Oh, that's... It seems to have been done. Yeah. So it's just...
What can I press?
I think that's forward.
That one.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. Well, I don't expect this extraordinary image needs any introduction to you. It is, of course, by the very young, extraordinarily precocious David Bomberg. Only, 2 years out of the Slade, and he comes up with this just monumentally revolutionary painting called The Mud Bath, and puts it on view a few months before the First World War breaks out at his first solo show in the Chenille Gallery in Chelsea. Oddly enough, not inside the gallery, but outside. He actually hangs it on the street, rather like a kind of sign outside a pub or a hotel. And he said later that the frame of it was covered in little Union Jacks all the way around. I mean, the obvious derivation of it is to do with his childhood growing up in the East End, because one of the places he used to go to on Brick Lane, when it was very, very much a Jewish community, was Shevzik's steam baths. And people used to go in there and bathe and relax. And okay, the mud bath derives from there. But with hindsight, we can look at it now and think, this painting is just uncannily prophetic. Because if you wanted to sum up what the First World War was all about, and of course you can't, or rather what it was like to people who fought in it, you could actually come up with those three words, couldn't you? You could come up with the mud bath. It seems to sum up so much of what was just so awful and degrading and traumatic about the First World War. Of course, Bomberg is not painting that. He's painting something which derives from the steam baths. But at the same time, of course, he's abstracting it hugely, so that you kind of question whether these are human figures. You question what the rectangle of red is. Is it a bath, or is it perhaps a bath of blood? Are these human beings, or are they robots? Are they dancing? Are they enjoying themselves? Are they leaping into the water? Or are they fighting? All these questions seem to arise in our minds as we look at it. And this was painted before the First World War, he said, pressing the arrow. Huh. Am I doing something wrong? Oh, well done. I was pointing it the wrong way around. Of course, Bomberg, like so many of his contemporaries who had studied at the Slade before the First World War, got caught up in the actual being a soldier bit of the First World War all too soon. And here is Bomberg. He didn't have much of a chance during the First World War to make images of what he was going through, and he went through hell because he really didn't have the time, he didn't have the resources, he was too busy being a soldier But there is this extraordinary drawing called Billet, which is now in the V&A collection and well worth going to see. One of his most powerful, big drawings of that period. And it's fascinating to compare it with Mudbath, actually, because compositionally it's not that different. There are these very abstracted, mechanistic figures. There is this huge rectangle stretching diagonally across the picture. But of course, the whole mood of it is so different. I mean, apart from the fact that it's black and white, these figures, I mean, one of them seems to be indulging in some kind of movement at the top, but most of it is a real tangle, isn't it, of limbs that cannot really be kind of dissociated from each other. They all seem to be exhausted. They all seem to be kind of resting on what is probably some kind of bed. And they're just shattered after a day of either training or something worse. So within a year, he was able to do that. And 1915 is actually quite early for images of the war as experienced by somebody who's going through it. Here's one of the great losses of the period. I'm afraid an awful lot of the greatest avant-garde work done in Britain at that time has, alas, been lost. And this is one of the most deplorable losses. It's by Wyndham Lewis, of course. And the only way we can identify is this reproduction, tantalizing reproduction, in Blast magazine. It's called Plan of War. And rather like the Bomberg, the Mudbath, it was done before the war. And again, it seems to kind of sum up a lot of the character of the First World War in the most uncanny way. We do know that it was a very large painting. We do know that it was very harshly, brightly coloured. So you have to kind of imagine that as you look at this reproduction. But it seems to be almost based on a kind of aerial view, doesn't it? Or some diagrammatic summation of these forces marshalling themselves against each other, either preparing for or beginning to indulge in some kind of combat. And here's Lewis about a year later, painting that's familiar to us all, because mercifully it has survived, unlike most of Lewis's big oil paintings of that period. It's called The Crowd, and it has a fascinating relationship, as so often with Lewis, with the work that he did as a writer of fiction. Because, of course, all through his life, he was this sort of dual beast, wasn't he? He was making his images, drawings and paintings, but he was also writing away not only art criticism, but also, of course, fiction, novel after novel after novel. And this has a relationship with The Crowd Master, which is a short story that he published in Blast magazine at that time. And it's a short story, really, about the extraordinary atmosphere of London, the centre of London, when the news got around that the First World War had been declared, and how lots of people almost instinctively kind of converged on Trafalgar Square and the area around it and just sort of stood there, almost as if they were kind of expecting something to happen, almost as if they wanted to participate in this new era that had suddenly burst upon them. It's not simply a painting about a short story. It is a painting, above all, perhaps, about the relationship between the crowds of tiny little figures, one of whom is trying to leap forward with a flag in protest, in revolution, we don't really know, right in the middle there almost. But of course, all these figures seem to be very much made almost insignificant by the great bands and bars of colour that stretch their way across the painting, representing maybe the architecture of a city. Certainly, we know that Lewis was fascinated at that time by photographs of New York, a city that he'd never visited when he was a young man, but he came to know through, above all, the photographs of Alvin Langdon Coburn. And the whole mood of the painting is very much sort of summed up by this. There's the beginning of a word here, E-N-C-L-O. So you immediately start thinking of the word enclosure or enclosed. And I think that's a very appropriate word for the painting, because the bars of colour stretching across it are rather prison-like, aren't they? They are rather containing, they're stamping their authority. There's no suggestion in this painting that Lewis is an artist like the Italian futurists of that period who greeted war, at least at the beginning, with huge enthusiasm and thought that it was what the world needed in order to reform itself, to, quote, cleanse itself. There's nothing of that feeling about the crowd at all. And here's an extraordinarily powerful drawing, again in the collection of the V&A. The V&A has some of Wyndham Lewis's best drawings of this period, a wonderful collection that was given to them many, many years ago. And it's an image of combat. It's an image of these three clusters of figures who seem to be not just fighting, but almost kind of merging with each other. It reminds one a bit, doesn't it, of that Bomberg drawing of the billet where they're merging. But of course, in the Bomberg, they're very exhausted and they're kind of flopped on the bed. Whereas here, they're very much entangled with each other, almost to the point where they seem to be indulging in some kind of strange sort of dance, a mechanistic dance. Very interesting to think of it in relation to Epstein's rock drill, because it was drawn at a time when Wyndham Lewis and Epstein, who fell out afterwards, were actually quite close and talked a lot and influenced each other. You could almost see this as a kind of draftsman-like equivalent of what Epstein was up to in the rock drill sculpture. And here, of course, is the cover of the second and, as it turned out, sadly, last issue of Blast magazine, the War Number, as Lewis called it, July 1915, is printed on the cover there. And it's an image that Lewis himself, of course, drew about soldiers involved in the conflict in Belgium. And by this time, you get the feeling that he's almost sort of bringing together the figures that he drew in the drawing, the combat drawing, with the much more abstract elements that he dealt with, especially in this one, the plan of war, sometime before the war broke out. They all seem to be sort of brought together, don't they, in this new drawing that he does for the magazine that he edited so superbly well. Now I want to turn to Nevinson. I've already mentioned the Italian futurists and how they greeted the war with such enthusiasm. The British artists didn't really, I mean, they were fascinated by futurism and learnt a lot from them, especially when the Futurists exhibited in London in 1912. By the time the First World War appeared, they were all very kind of sceptical about the Futurists, apart from this one young guy who, like Bomberg, had studied at the Slade. He was pretty much the same age as Bomberg and so many other of those talented young men who were students there in that remarkable era. And here is Bomberg, Nevinson, not only declaring himself to be the British futurist, but engaged in producing a painting which, again, completely lost. I hope one of you might find it one day in a junk shop, all rolled up in a dusty corner. It'd be great to rediscover it. This is the only known reproduction of it, too. It's called, as you can see from this headline, Tum Tiddly Um Tum Pom Pom. And Nimson must have spent an enormous amount of time working on it. I think you can see from the caption here, it says, our picture is of the futurist masterpiece, unquote, by Mr. C.R.W. Nimson, entitled Tum Tiddly Um Tum Pom Pom. It represents Hampstead Heath on a bank holiday. Real confetti has been showered into the paint, which reminds us of Severini over in Paris, one of the best futurist artists with whom Nemenson had by this time a friendship. The picture shows, at least the artist claims it shows, this is the Western male being kind of rather sarcastic, the chaotic movement, noise and enthusiasm of the bank holiday crowd. Well, I think we can look at it as something which, again, almost seems to sort of prefigure the chaos of the First World War. It also, interestingly enough, prefigures what Mark Gertler went on to do with his masterpiece during the First World War, when he in turn went up to Hampstead Heath, looked at the funfair crowd, and did that extraordinary image called Merry-Go-Round. It would be great, wouldn't it, to rediscover the Nevinson. That's, of course, Nevinson himself standing next to it. And put it side by side with the Merry-Go-Round, because it is, in the end, a very different painting. It is much more joyful, much more boisterous. And right in the middle is this grinning head, right at the top there in the middle, which looks back to a painting that Boccioni had done a few years back called The Laugh. As the war approached, so Nevinson's mood grew darker. This is a drawing, again, we don't know where it is, but here's the repro of it, and it's called The Strand. By now we've got Keep Smiling written on the side of the bus, but nobody's smiling at the bottom of the drawing at all. They're all very much caught up in something quite grim, something that nobody in England, let alone the rest of the world, had ever really experienced before. And Nevinson, of course, became more and more involved in the First World War. As the only British futurist, he made sure that he went over to France as soon as he could, serving in the ambulance brigade. Before he went, he painted this picture called The Arrival, which didn't sell when he first put it on view, and so he renamed it when the First World War broke out and called it My Arrival in Dunkirk. But I don't think it sold because it was given finally by his widow to the Tate Gallery. But here is Nevinson over in France. He didn't last there very long. He was invalided out, in fact, because he was overwhelmed, as so many people were, by the unprecedented horror, the unprecedented carnage. He was part of an ambulance service that really could not cope. There's something almost stunned about his expression even here, which is a photograph that he very proudly sent off to his friend Marinetti in Milan, and that's where the photograph survives, in the Marinetti archive. But it says quite a lot, I think, about what Nevinson went through at that time. And it is extraordinary to me that, having been invalided out, he almost immediately started work. And I think it probably did him a huge amount of good. He started work on images of the First World War at a time when, at a very early stage in the war, actually, when very few people were actually feeling that they could get round to do such a thing. He's already pushing himself. He's getting married. He spends his honeymoon in England on the coast, and his wife very stoically said afterwards that it was a very difficult honeymoon because my new husband spend all his time drawing and painting these obsessive images of war. And of course, returning to the trenches, you already feel, although it is a deeply futurist painting in terms of the style, in terms of the dynamism, it is at the same time not a futurist painting, because it doesn't actually cheer on the gallant troops marching towards victory. It's about something much darker than that. It's about something, I mean, this is painting between 1914 and 1915, so it's very early, but already Nevinson is sensing, isn't he, that these soldiers are actually caught up in some kind of grinding process over which they really have no control at all. They're already looking, especially those faces on the right side of the painting, they're already looking gaunt and exhausted, and it's almost as if they're moving towards their own inevitable destruction. Here, of course, is a painting which ended up in the Tate collection. It ended up here quite early, in fact, and it's one of Nevinson's most impressive First World War pictures. The mitrailleurs, where he zeroes in, doesn't he, on this machine gun, this instrument that was the pride of the forces who wielded it. But at the same time, of course, it inflicted an unbelievable amount of destruction on the soldiers who, as we can see anyway, very naively advanced towards it and were just mown down in their hundreds and thousands. Not that the people who've got the machine gun are themselves invulnerable, because, of course, even the guy who's got his hand on the machine and is presumably about to fire it, he looks very, very, I don't know, almost cornered. Nevinson is very good at barbed wire and shafts of light in the sky, almost this sort of metallic sky, which adds to this feeling of confinement. And of course, the guy next to the mitrailleurs is yelling, probably yelling for help, because the man beneath him is either dead or dying, the man with the upturned nose in the shadows at the bottom there. So it's not a picture about people who have a machine gun and will kill everybody else and feel quite happy about it. It's a painting really about the fact that even if you've got these machines, there's no escape, and the other guys have got them too. And I don't know, you're just caught, aren't you? There's a tremendous feeling of confinement, of people feeling trapped. And this is a less familiar painting, still in a private collection, but it's one that Nevinson actually planned on his honeymoon in 1915. It's called Flooded Trench on the Isere. And I think it's one of his very, very finest First World War pictures, quite extraordinary, devoting a lot of the picture space to the sky, to this, again, very metallic sky, through which the rain seems to be lancing almost like spears down towards the ground. And I mean, what do we find there? Okay, we find a trench, but boy, has it been flooded. To the point where you just wonder how human beings could actually survive in these conditions, let alone the fact that they were at war, let alone the fact that there were machine guns and bombs and goodness knows what else threatening them. The actual trenches themselves, when you have downpours like this, particularly in the winter, and there's something very glacial, isn't there, about this painting, you just sort of think, well, no one can survive such an ordeal. And here's a page from the newspaper cuttings, which Nevinson kept, which are, in fact, in the archive here at Tate. And he was a great keeper of the press coverage of his work, partly, I think, because his father was in his day, Henry Nevinson, he was in his day a very celebrated journalist. He was a war correspondent, in fact. So he must have taught CRW a thing or two about war. And I think he helped CRW to contact the press and engage with his work. Looking through the press cuttings, you do actually realize quite how famous CRW became during the course of the First World War, how vigorously he was debated, how controversial he became. And I have a particular interest in this image because the right-hand painting is of a picture called The Bursting Shell. And soon after, I organized a show at the Hayward Gallery in the 1970s called Vorticism and Its Allies. I was contacted by the gallery. They said, oh, somebody's just written to us from St. John's Wood. They've got a dirty old painting in the cupboard, and they think it might have something to do with your exhibition. So I went round there to this flat, and literally it was in a cupboard, and it was very, very grubby indeed. And they had no idea who it was by. It had nothing written on it. They said it had been given to them by a dead uncle, and they just wondered whether it was something that they ought to look after. And luckily, I had very recently seen this photograph of a bursting shell in the Nevinson press cuttings, and I could sort of dimly discern it through the dirt in this painting. And I said, this is a really very important painting indeed, and if you want to sell it, it would be lovely if you could sell it to the Tate. And I'm delighted to say that's where it's ended up. It is, once again, one of his best pictures. In fact, these two pictures show how much of a range Nevinson had at that time, because The Bursting Shell is a very abstract kind of painting, forcing us to look down on the moment of impact where everything is being destroyed by the shafts of the bomb. Whereas the other one is much more to do with people. But, of course, people in relation to, again, he's very good, isn't he, at the place that surrounds them and confines them and traps them. He was a very aware artist, very, very good at summing up the central dilemma facing everybody who struggled so hard to fight during the First World War. Here's another page from the press cuttings book which shows how controversial Nevinson became. Will these pictures help the Germans? Extraordinary headline. I don't know quite how they would help the Germans, but certainly that's how newspapers, of course, as today, they still do it, don't they? They want to sell copies and they want to inflame the readership. And here is one of Nevinson's finest achievements. It's simply called Troops Resting. It belongs, as I'm sure you know, to the Imperial War Museum. And I don't know, I think it kind of sums up. It's 1916 by this time, so we're halfway through the war. We're approaching, or have approached, the worst bit, where so many people get killed. It's 2 years into a war that now seems to be dragging on forever. It seems endless, it seems limitless. And although all they're doing is resting, it seems to be much more than that, doesn't it? It seems to be almost troops despairing, troops wondering what on earth is going on and why they're there, and is there any end in sight? Again, there's a very good use of the sky, very good use of the road stretching up rather grimly on the right-hand side. But above all, these figures, okay, they're still protected, aren't they? They've got their helmets, they've got their weapons, they've got all sorts of stuff attached to their backs, but they're sort of burdened by it, aren't they? They can hardly kind of sustain the energy that it needs to carry on up that road, and they're probably saying to each other, you know, when will it all end? I've just had it. And of course we now know that by the end of the war there was considerable amount of psychic despair. David Bomberg actually shot himself. He administered a self-inflicted wound towards the end of his time in the armed forces. And a lot of other people did too. A lot of people had breakdowns, even if they weren't actually killed or injured. They had breakdowns. A lot of people never recovered mentally from what they'd been through at that time. And I think Nevinson's painting goes a long way towards defining that. Well, thank you very much.